sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocritics. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl.
President Trump recently said this.
We've been fighting for a long time in Syria. I've been president for almost 2 years, and we've really stepped it up. And we have won against ISIS. We've beaten them, and we've beaten them badly. We've taken back the land, and now it's time for our troops to come back home.
As I've stated on previous shows, it's very difficult to understand what's going on in Syria, the Middle East, and in the global war on terror in general, without some understanding of 9/11 and the globalist wish for a new world order with everything under their control. 9/11 brought about permanent war, and there's extensive research that shows that 9/11 was not carried out by Osama bin Laden and the 19 guys with box cutters. The evidence points to elements of our own U.S. government and the neocons with close ties to Israel and Israel itself, with Pakistan and Saudi Arabia as minor players. The war since 9/11 were planned well in advance of 9/11, but a new Pearl Harbor was needed to get the American people to support these wars. Here's what General Wesley Clark revealed about the 9/11 wars.
About 10 days after 9/11, I went through the Pentagon and I saw Secretary Rumsfeld and Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz. I went downstairs just to say hello to some of the people on the Joint Staff who had used to work for me. And one of the generals called me and he said, "Sir, you got to come in. You got to come in and talk to me a second." I said, "Well, you're too busy." He said, "No." He says, "We've made the decision. We're going to war with Iraq." This was on or about the 20th of September. I said, "We're going to war with Iraq. Why?" He said, "I don't know." He said, "I guess they don't know what else to do." So I said, "Well, did they find some information connecting Saddam to Al-Qaeda?" He said, no. He says, "There's nothing new that way. They just made the decision to go to war with Iraq." He said, "I guess it's like we don't know what to do about terrorists, but we've got a good military and we can take down governments." And he said, "I guess if the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem has to look like a nail." So I came back to see him a few weeks later. And by that time, we were bombing in Afghanistan. I said, "Are we still going to war with Iraq?" And he said, "Oh, it's worse than that." He said, he reached over on his desk, he picked up a piece of paper. And he said, I just got this down from upstairs, meaning the Secretary of Defense's office today. And he said, "This is a memo that describes how we're going to take out 7 countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran."
But what President Trump and General Wesley Clark both failed to mention is that the CIA created and supported Al-Qaeda and worked with Osama bin Laden. They can move them into any country they want as a pretext to attack that country under the guise of fighting the terrorists. And this is exactly what's been going on in Syria. But first, let's listen to Michel Trusadovsky setting the stage for where we're at today.
For the opportunity to address this important subject of September 11 and also establish the links between the so-called war on terrorism and the issues underlying the process of globalization. We are not dealing with separate realities. We are dealing with the interface between war and the conquest of economic frontiers through the application of these deadly IMF World Bank reforms, which have characterized the international scene for the last 20 years and which have led to economic and social devastation throughout the developing countries, but also in most of the developed countries where similar reforms under the auspices of national governments and financial markets have also been applied. So we must understand war and globalization are intricately related, and war is the structural adjustment of last resort. It destroys institutions, it kills people, and ultimately it is an instrument of economic conquest. We must understand the events of September 11. The war on terrorism is a fabrication from A to Z. We have piles of documents which prove unequivocally that this is not a war on terrorism, but it is a war of conquest, which is marked by the extension of America's sphere of influence into Central Asia. This war has been long in the making, in the planning stages. September 11 is a pretext for waging war on the grounds that one has to go after Osama bin Laden. Now, we have to also understand that in the wake of 9/11, we are perhaps facing the most serious crisis in modern history. It is not only marked by the collapse of living standards all over the world, which are the consequence precisely of the neoliberal reforms applied universally and which have impoverished millions of people. And this poverty is not the result of any scarcity of resources, quite the opposite. The system has unlimited capacity to produce, yet the very process of its expansion worldwide leads to essentially impoverishing people by minimizing employment and by minimizing wages and so on. And the war on terrorism is in fact the counterpart of this process. It supports the process of globalization, it destroys national sovereignties, and it extends the American empire into new frontiers. Let me say a few words. This is well documented that Osama bin Laden is a creation of the CIA. In fact, nobody actually denies that. What they say is Osama is a creation of the CIA and he went against us. Now, believe it or not, he went against us. We helped this guy back in the early 80s. We helped him. We brought the Mujahideen. We set up the madrasas. We had the training camps. We put in place the Pakistan Inter-Services Intelligence, which was there to help Osama, and so on and so forth. All this is documented in many, many books and articles. But the question which I'd like to address now, the CIA says, Osama went against us. This is a blowback. They call it a blowback. In intelligence jargon, it means that an intelligence asset goes against the sponsors. Okay? That's a blowback. We helped Osama and he's now turned against Uncle Sam. Well, I can tell you that that is simply not true. And I will present the evidence to you that Osama bin Laden is still an intelligence asset of the US government. His Al-Qaeda has collaborated with successive US administrations, including Bush, including Clinton and Bush Jr. And you might be interested to know that in July, 2 months before September 11, Osama bin Laden was hospitalized in this beautiful American hospital in Dubai. And he was receiving treatment for his kidney problems, which he had caught while sitting in damp caves in Afghanistan. But in any event, this is based on a report published in the French daily Le Figaro, which is one of France's largest newspapers. During his 15-day stay in the hospital, he was visited by the CIA, a head of station in the United Arab Emirates. And there was no attempt made to either arrest him or deport him. He was given treatment in a hospital which was connected or tied to the U.S. Embassy in the United Arab Emirates. If you go to the embassy's homepage, you'll find the telephone number of the hospital where Osama was treated. And incidentally, here is the CIA visiting Osama on his hospital bed while he's recovering from his kidney problems. And incidentally, on the 10th of September, Osama bin Laden was back in hospital in Rawalpindi, in a military hospital in Rawalpindi. Anybody who has been to Rawalpindi knows that the place, it's the headquarters of the Pakistani military. It's swarming with US military advisors. The US military mission is close by. It is impossible that Osama bin Laden could have been hospitalized on the 10th of September. I don't know when he was released. The report doesn't say. But everybody knew in the high ranks of the Pakistani military and the U.S. military that he was in hospital in Rawalpindi. And the source of this information, which has not been refuted, I love mainstream sources, Dan Rather, CBS News. Now, Dan Rather, CBS News, goes to Rawalpindi and interviews a number of people about this, and then it's broadcast. Of course, everybody says it's not relevant. Of course it's relevant. Of course. In other words, we have to connect the dots. If, in fact, he was hospitalized in Dubai and hospitalized again in Rawalpindi and he has a kidney problem and he was never arrested, and if Donald Rumsfeld says we will have to use nuclear weapons to go after him, obviously there's somebody is lying somewhere, right? Because, and I have the quotes from Donald Rumsfeld saying that they will use nuclear weapons against Osama. Now, if in effect they had been interested at all in arresting him, they would have done it, but they didn't. And the fact of the matter is that Al-Qaeda network, which was created by the CIA in 79 and which gained prominence throughout the 80s, alongside the development of Pakistan's military intelligence apparatus, which was also supported by the CIA, all this was a process which was supposed to be against the Soviet Union at the time, to have the Mujahideen fight on behalf of Uncle Sam. Of course, they didn't necessarily know they were fighting on behalf of Uncle Sam, because intelligence assets act wittingly or unwittingly in relation to their sponsors. That's the nature of an intelligence operation. But bear in mind that in the wake of the Cold War, none of this infrastructure was disbanded. Osama bin Laden's Al-Qaeda continued, the links with Pakistan's inter-services intelligence continued, and the links to agencies of the U.S. government continued as well. I will give you documentary evidence of that statement. Essentially, what you have is the following. The ISI historically has played, is the institutional base for channeling support to Islamic insurgencies in different parts of the world, but particularly in the former Soviet Union, the Balkans, the Middle East, but also in other regions. And Pakistan's inter-services intelligence is a vast bureaucratic military apparatus which was set up with the support of the CIA in the early 80s. It was set up under the government of General ضیاء-الحق Haq in the early 80s. It developed into a vast network of agents, but also it had a military component, and it supported both Osama bin Laden, but also the Taliban. And bear in mind, the Taliban were supported by the United States. They were always supported by the United States. They would never have been able to form a government in 1996 had it not been for the support of Pakistan's inter-services intelligence and the Pakistan military, as well as military aid which was channeled using Pakistan's ISI as a go-between to the Taliban and to Osama. In summer of 2001, the ISI chief General Mahmoud Atta transferred $100,000 to the ringleader of 9/11. Now understand that the ISI has also very close links with the CIA. This information is confirmed by a number of reports, including an FBI report, which points to the transfer of money, but doesn't identify the name of the individual who is behind the transfer. But it's confirmed by Agence France-Presse and the Times of India and an Indian intelligence report that it was the ISI which transferred this money to the ringleader of 9/11. Now, curiously and incidentally, the FBI report, which was quoted by an ABC News story in late September, talks about the money man behind the terrorists. The money man, the architect, I'm using their terms, the money man, the architect behind 9/11. Now, the money man behind 9/11 is Mahmoud Ahmad, head of the ISI, not necessarily as an individual, but as the chief of an organization which is closely in liaison with the CIA. Now, these reports are unequivocal because they're based, again, on the FBI. The FBI says, very textually, you can read it in our magazine, because we've reproduced these quotes, that they can trace the money trail. They know who is behind it. And in fact, subsequent reports say it's Mahmoud Ahmad. Now, Mahmoud Ahmad arrives in the United States on the 4th of September. Now, is this event related or unrelated to 9/11? I think it is. He arrives on the 4th, and the press briefings say General Mahmoud is here on a routine visit of consultations with his U.S. counterparts. Now, who are his U.S. counterparts? George Tenet of the CIA, the Richard Armitage in the State Department, Mark Grossman, and so on and so forth. I mean, these are his counterparts. He has top-level meetings with these individuals in the course of his week-long consultation. But more importantly, in the wake of 9/11, he also meets up with U.S. officials to discuss the cooperation of Pakistan in the war on terrorism. So that what you have here, essentially, is the money man behind 9/11, according to FBI reports, on an official visit, given red carpet treatment in Washington, with meetings at the State Department, at the White House, at the Pentagon, and the CIA. And in the wake of 9/11, Mahmoud Ahmad comes on the 4th. He has meetings with his U.S. counterparts. On the 11th of September, there are several meetings of the National Security Council, which the first one takes place actually by video telephone from Offutt Air Force Base, where President Bush had been taken. The other members of the National Security Council are in Washington. And at that meeting, George Tenet essentially feeds the assumptions to President Bush that Osama bin Laden is behind the attacks, and Bush gives the green light to wage the war on terrorism. And then the final meeting is at 11 o'clock at night. It's a meeting of the War Cabinet where they agree on their strategy. What happens the following morning? They said, we're going to go after the terrorists. We're going to deploy all this military might. It was all decided in the evening of September 11. On September 12th in the morning, Richard Armitage, perhaps one of the most powerful members of the Bush administration, together with George Tenet and a couple of other people, Richard Armitage meets with Mahmoud Ahmad, the money man, the architect behind the 9/11 terrorists. And what is the subject matter of their meetings? Cooperation of the ISI in waging the war on terrorism. Doesn't that sound a little bit contradictory that the money man behind 9/11, and I'm quoting the FBI, would be invited to help the U.S. administration in going after Osama? Of course, Osama is an intelligence asset of the U.S. government, and so the whole issue, of course, is all the inconsistencies, I think, start to emerge. But there you are, the U.S. government signs, has an agreement which is then finalized a day later on the 13th, and General Mahmoud Ahmad states that they will cooperate in helping the U.S. administration in going after Osama bin Laden. It's a little bit like asking the devil to go after Dracula. Because in fact, the terrorists in the 9/11, the terrorists were instruments, and they were instruments of a well-prepared intelligence operation, which emanates out of Pakistan's inter-services intelligence. Now, if then the Bush administration asks Pakistan's inter-services intelligence to collaborate in the war on terrorism, when in fact the money man behind these terrorist attacks emanates from Pakistan's ISI, then I think we can safely infer if we're looking at the proximity group of this individual, I mean, in my faculty of social sciences, I deal with sociologists and anthropologists who like to look at proximity groups. And if they looked at the proximity group of this individual, say, ah, he's a buddy of Mohammed Atta, but he's also a buddy of Richard Armitage, and he has a very close personal relationship with George Tenet. Okay? A very close personal relationship with George Tenet. And George Tenet has a very close personal relationship with the President of the United States. And that is fundamental in understanding how the military intelligence apparatus has in effect taken over the reins of government in the United States. The people who pull the strings, who are behind him, are the key individuals of the military intelligence apparatus. And behind those individuals, presumably, you have other brokers which belong to the financial and corporate establishment, which are also the oil companies, the banks, and so on, which certainly have links to the CIA. So this is the situation that we are in today. From my point of view, the foreknowledge is red herring. The foreknowledge issue is a red herring because obviously they knew. They keep track of their intelligence assets. If Osama bin Laden is an intelligence asset to this day, and the evidence proves it beyond doubt, then obviously the US government knows everything about Osama bin Laden, and it also points, although I don't want to necessarily draw, this is still a very complex process, but it does point at least to cover up, complicity and deception. Complicity of senior officials of the Bush administration, the fact that Richard Armitage meets up with the money man behind the terrorists and so on, I think at least that should be investigated.
That ultimately this is the only way to prevent what has been announced, which is a major military adventure which threatens the future of humanity. Thank you very much.
And again, you were just listening to Professor Michelle Chosudovsky of globalresearch.ca. And now this is what Stephen Gowans has to say in his book titled Washington's Long War on Syria. On behalf of Wall Street, the United States' most politically influential sector, successive U.S. governments waged a war on Arab nationalist Syria, not to support the spread of democracy, which Syria's Arab nationalists had developed to a far higher degree than had Washington's prized Arab allies, but to eliminate opposition to a Washington-led global economic order, which prioritized the pursuit of profit above all other considerations. From 1963, Syrian governments, in which Ba'ath Arab Socialist Party members Hafez al-Assad and his son Bashar played principal roles, were committed to the Arab nationalist values of freedom from foreign domination and Arab socialism. Syria's secular Arab nationalist government forged alliances with the Islamic Republic of Iran, which likewise rejected integration into the U.S. superintended global economic order and valued economic and political independence. The values which the Assad-led Syrian government embraced were inimical to the U.S. foreign policy goal of creating highly favorable business climates for the U.S. corporations, bankers, and investors around the world. In place of pandering to Wall Street, Syrian Arab nationalists sought to free Syria, and as an ultimate goal, the entire world, from the political and economic agendas of foreign powers. In the spring of 2011, upheaval shook the Arab world. The distemper became known as the Arab Spring. Riots broke out in Syria in March 2011 and quickly turned into an insurgency. Washington almost immediately called for its old Arab nemesis, Bashar al-Assad, to step down. U.S. President Barack Obama declared that Assad had lost legitimacy, citing the armed rebellion as proof. Other countries Washington had opposed in the region, Iran, Gaddafi's Libya, and Saddam's Iraq, were like Syria, committed to economic and political independence and state-directed development at odds with the paradigm favored by the U.S. State Department on behalf of U.S. banks, corporations, and investors. The United States' efforts to oust the government of Bashar al-Assad antedated the Arab Spring by many years, and Washington had had a hand in inciting the Muslim Brotherhood, which had a long history of violent antagonism toward the Syrian government dating to 1963. Washington's motivation to topple Bashar al-Assad's government prior to 2011 was related to Damascus's embrace of anti-imperialist and anti-Zionist positions and its program of state-directed economic development. And again, that was from Stephen Gowan's book called Washington's Long War on Syria. ISIS and al-Nusra in Syria are nothing more than an evolved al-Qaeda, supported and controlled by the U.S. and its Western allies. And now here's Michelle Chusadovsky again to talk to you about that. And this comes from an interview on Press TV.
I think that those who accuse, in fact, have blood on their hands. NATO has blood on their hands. The United States has blood on their hands. Why? Because they have supported an armed insurgency back from the outset in March of 2011. It is known and documented that this so-called opposition is in fact a proxy military formation or paramilitary formation which is supported by the Western Military Alliance. We also know that there are special forces from NATO countries which have integrated this so-called opposition, namely the Free Syrian Army. We know that Turkey is supplying the so-called opposition with weapons, and this has been going on for several months. And we also have very well-documented evidence to the effect that most of the civilian casualties are attributable to terrorist acts by opposition gunmen and paramilitary. We must, I think, know who are the sides, okay? Because on the one hand, you have the government of Syria, and on the other, you have, in fact, the foot soldiers of NATO. This is a plan to destabilize Syria as a nation state. It's part of a broader military agenda, which has been ongoing for several years. And the United States and NATO have a broader military agenda. This isn't really an opposition. This is an opposition within Syria. This is a fabricated opposition. Many of the people, or the gunmen who are fighting, are in fact mercenaries from neighboring countries, in particular from Qatar, from Iraq. In other words, they're not even Syrian nationals. So this so-called opposition is made out in large part by terrorist brigades, which are covertly supported by the Gulf states, Qatar in particular, Saudi Arabia, but also the Western Military Alliance. They have been seeking from the outset regime change, and in other words, toppling the government and destabilizing the country.
And here's what former U.S. diplomat Jim Douglas has to say about Syria on an interview with Scotty on RT. He's asked here about his thoughts on Trump's withdrawal of troops from Syria.
I think it is a big win for America. It's the right thing. It's long overdue, and I'm glad to see it. I hope it sticks. He certainly has the power, certainly he has the legal authority. In fact, there's no legal basis for us to be in Syria at all. So he's on very strong ground if that's what he wants to do. The question is, will his underlings actually carry out his instructions, or will they try to sandbag him, make exceptions to it, slow roll him on the timetable? We'll still have some contractors there, et cetera, et cetera. I think one of the things that actually strengthens his hand, paradoxically, is the fact that the Turks are preparing to move into that area of Syria. And evidently, he did talk to President Erdogan recently. Maybe this gives him an excuse to do what he wants to do. I notice this tweet, he says, my priority has been defeating ISIS. He knows that's not the priority of the people he's appointed. I think there are a couple of things here. One is on the regime change thing. I'm sure that's what a lot of those people want, but they're in a very weak position to make that argument. The Assad government is not going anywhere. It is staying in power. You'd have to be, frankly, insane not to recognize that that is the case. What they're really there is, this is part of their strategy to try to have regime change in Tehran. It really has less to do with Syria than it does with Iran. The other thing, of course, is that on the question of ISIS, you're going to get this argument. Senator Lindsey Graham made this argument today that if we pull out, it will create a vacuum and we'll have a resurgence of ISIS, just like we saw in Iraq when Obama pulled out of Iraq. That is such a baseless myth. in terms of what is really going on. What is really allowing the opportunity for groups like ISIS, like Al-Qaeda, is the fact that outside powers are supporting them, have been supporting these terrorists to overthrow the Syrian government. And what we need is a reestablishment of the authority of the legal Syrian government.
So will the withdrawal of U.S. troops bring peace to Syria? Or will our proxy armies and our allies keep the assault on Assad going? This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.